So good evening, Bodhisattvas. Welcome to our second annual Desert Rain Zen Spring Retreat. Many more. If you were here last year, welcome back. If it's your first retreat, welcome, and we hope welcome forward. We're calling this still the Desert Sunrise Retreat. And here we are, early March in the Sonoran Desert again, with the rocks and the cactus and the birds and all that usual stuff. So is this a different place that we're in, or the same place again? Is it a different time or the same time again? The usual Zen way of answering questions like those is yes, which is actually more helpful than it might at first appear to be. I want to start by exploring and also enacting that sense of a kind of looping back to the same place by literally starting this talk the way I started the one last year. So if you were here last time, deja vu all over again. So this is a commentary from case 20 of the Blue Cliff Record. Nguyen Mu says this: "Haven't you heard? Wu She went to see Shitto. He had made an agreement." Shitto's a great teacher, Shitto Shichen, 8th century about. "He had made an agreement with himself beforehand, saying, 'If there's a court at the first word, I'll stay. Otherwise, I'll go.' Shitto just sat on his seat. She shook out his sleeves and went out. Shitto knew that Wu She was a vessel of truth, so he had, actually, extended his teaching to him. But She hadn't understood his meaning. He had announced his departure and gone out." He shakes out his sleeves in a sign of contempt and starts walking toward the threshold. "When he got to the gate, Shitto called out to him, 'Reverend.' When She looked back, Shitto said, 'From birth to death, it's only this. Don't seek any more for anything else by turning your head and revolving your brain.' At these words, She was greatly enlightened. So it's only this, wherever you are and whoever you are, birth to death." I want to start not with the looping around part of this story, but with you're just an ordinary bloke living your ordinary life, and the teacher says to you, it's just this, no matter where you are, just this regular you. And I'm going to go into the looping at the same time by retelling quickly two stories I told last time. And I want to emphasize again this, the importance of just being here as yourself. So these are both kind of goofy stories, but they're both, at least for me, important Zen experiences. There was a retreat a long time ago in Santa Fe where Joan was trying to make the teaching, I suppose, more American. And she told us that as we crossed over the threshold, as we did tonight to begin the retreat, I think the leaders were already in the room, and we were supposed to say our name. So you'd walk through the threshold and say, "I'm Tenny, I'm Bill." And it was a little, as I think I said last year, it felt a little bit like the Howdy Doody show, you know, "Hi kids, I'm here." But I really felt like I hadn't left myself behind and that wasn't the project of the retreat. And so it was very freeing and wonderful while being kind of silly. Another story I remember, we used to, a long time ago, to do retreats in robes. And one of the retreats at the Girl Scout camp in Tucson, where for the first time we weren't in robes, I remember doing a long outdoor walk with the other people at the retreat. And there were just all these, you know, actually fairly old people, you know, kind of not schlumping, but just sort of wandering through the wash. And they weren't really wandering because they were walking in single file, but, you know, in jeans and khakis and shorts. And it felt really sad for a minute. You know, it's like, it was really better when everybody had on the black robes and they were Zen students. And it was just a lot of people actually taking kind of a lovely but ordinary walk through the wash and getting older at every step, I guess. And that seemed really poignant and really important, you know. So William Carlos Williams, the American poet, says that it's important to know that we're alive as ourselves. And so one part of that story about Reverend birth to death, it's only this, is, you know, it's not going to happen to somebody else. It's not going to happen at some other time or some other place. So if you're coming here trying to find some special Zen self that can get enlightened, and you think if you just run fast enough to leave your ordinary self behind, and then it'll happen, that's probably not the right way to go about it, and it probably won't work. But this year I want to emphasize also the sense of looping back that I hear, or looping to the same place in Reverend Birth to Death, It's Only This. Well, it's only what? What this, or this what? It's only this all the time. Suzuki Roshi apparently used to say, and his students tried to correct his grammar, it was important to realize things as it is. And they said, no, don't you mean, you know, Roshi, things as they are? And he said, no, things as it is. So in some sense, it's only this one thing. And in some way, the this is always the same thing. So one version of that story is that right where you are, and right where you're sitting, and right where you walk, and right where you're sleeping and eating, it's this, and you're this. Suzuki also used to say, you're the boss. I love this one. When the boss sleeps, everybody sleeps. It's kind of crazy. But where you sit is right at the center. You are the center. And the topology of it is kind of strange because everybody's right at the center as well. But where you sit, you're the boss. You're at the center. When the boss sleeps, everybody sleeps. Birth to death. It's only this. The source comes right out of you and right through you and radiates through you. So another thing we know from Shitto, who's that teacher who said, Reverend Birth to Death, it's only this, is taking part in the gathering, which derives from a great Taoist poem. And toward the beginning, it says, the source of the bright is clear and unstained. Branches of light stream from that dark. So right up out of that Taoist darkness or nothingness, branches of light stream. And then a few lines later on, we and everything we perceive are interwoven and not interwoven. That's interesting. And this interweaving goes on and on while each thing stands in its own place. And what I want to suggest is that right here and right now, that's coming up right through you. The branches of light are streaming right up through the dark, right where you sit. And right where you sit is the center. You don't have to go looking anywhere for the mystery or the light, because you are the mystery and the light. Somebody reported to me recently being at a retreat, and a teacher said really helpfully, they could say moo in old style, but I think they said no, which is our version of the koan. When you lie down, no lies down. When you go for a walk, no goes for a walk. And I think that's the same thing. Only this, always at the center. So one question for a retreat or other times as well is, how do you hold those really contrary feelings, or feelings that at least seem contrary? So my version of it is, well, I'm just a guy named Tenny, a cranky old man with a lot of crutches and foibles. And if you think that's not true, you can ask my kids. You know? And at the same time, I'm the conduit for the mystery and the light, and they come right up through me at every moment. I think one way to think about how to hold them both, though this may seem a joke, it isn't, is to hold it lightly. You know, be easy with it, which sometimes feels hard. Because really, it's a win-win situation. If you wake up tomorrow and you're in the hall and you're a cranky old man, you know, or a cranky old woman or a cranky young woman, that's fine, you know, just be that. And the next moment, you may feel that you're at the center and everything shines right through you, and that's fine too. And so either way, you can't go wrong. And I think if you don't tense up around it, it'll tend to shift. And it's also true, and a lot of us know this from sitting, I think all of us know some version of it from sitting, is sometimes they really do feel like they've melded into the same thing. You can't anymore tell which is which. You know, it's exactly the old cranky guy that's got the light shining right through him. So I'll tell a story on my friend Bill. I remember back in the old days at Zen Desert Sangha, there was a Wednesday night discussion group, and a Vipassana guy, I don't have anything against Vipassana guys, but a Vipassana guy who was actually the ex-boyfriend of a poet that I knew, said, but I thought it was kind of useful, that he thought Zen was really good with emptiness, but it really didn't help you at all with form, you know. And Bill said, you know, just, oh, they're the same thing, you know. And the guy said, well, yeah, I know that working on emptiness really actually helps you to deal with the world of form. And Bill said, no, they're the same thing. And that's something that he really knew. And I said, oh, Bill knows something, you know, I can hang out with this guy. You know, but sometimes it feels like that. They're both at once. So, I want to say a little bit about koans in this regard, because we're a koan group. And before I forget, I'll mention also that outside there's one pile of koans without paper clips that say koans for Dharma talks, and you can take one of those tonight if you want. And there's another pile of paper clips, so you would take one paper clip bunch, and that says koan seminar. So those are the koans that I hope to kind of have with us in one way or another throughout the retreat. But anyway, I think koans are like that too, you know, just any this that happens to be happening, and it's always this at the same time. So if you think about koans, they're vernacular, a lot of them. Some of them have poetry in them, but a lot of them are vernacular. They're often kind of testy or weird or unlikely conversations between two people. They don't necessarily take place in any very exalted circumstances. And the answers are often kind of gruff and grainy and ordinary, and you all know this. So, you know, what's Buddha? 3 pounds of flax. As long as we're in for a penny, we might as well be in for a pound. What's Buddha? Oh, a dried shit stick. That's another one, you know. Why did Bodhidharma come from the West? Oh, the oak tree in the garden, or we'd say in Arizona, the cottonwood by the wash. So it's just stuff, and that's really important. I think when we start working with koans, we're sometimes a little uncomfortable with that, or we want to know sort of what the holiness is or the point. And we tend to kind of ennoble them by allegorizing them. And so if somebody says, oh, the oak tree in the courtyard, we say, we don't talk like this anymore, but it's as if we said, lo, each thing has Buddha nature. You know, and then we've given ourselves some philosophy. And you all know this, but I want to really suggest and recommend that you not do that. You know, just be with the cottonwood by the wash, just be with the oak tree. Don't worry about the shit stick for right now, you know, but just be with the 3 pounds of flax or whatever it is, you know. And if you stick with that and stick to it as if for dear life, something will really happen. If you can just let them in and let that quality in, something will begin to shift without having to go through the philosophical interpretation. And koans in some way are weirdly shamanic. And if you just stick with the cottonwood, if you just stick with whatever it is, they really do take you to that place where you're right at the center, where everything at one and the same time is moving and clacking and buzzing, and at the same time it's large and spacious and silent and still. So if you're just with the particulars, that's fine. If something opens up, that's fine too, you know. So I'm talking about a practice, which is our practice as I understand it, that's a practice of living in and among apparent opposites, seeing what they'll open out to, without trying to leave either one behind, and without forcing one to turn into the other. And sometimes you do that. I'm going to sit with the cottonwood until I see the light shining through it. But if you can be a little more easy about it and just sit with the cottonwood with some concentration and some porosity and let it in, then the light will come shining right up through it. So I may have done this last year as well, I can't remember, which is kind of good since I'm talking about not knowing whether we're in the same place or a different place. But here's a little demonstration about something about opposites, which most of you know, if not from me, then from math class or something like that. So, you know this, right? So we know this, right? So there it is, right? That's what we do, right? And so it's got an outside surface and an inside surface. So they're opposites. We're on this side or we're on that side. We're on this team or we're on that team. We're the subject or the object or something like that. And then somebody thought of, you know, that. You do one 180 degree twist. There are three more of these that I'll pass around later maybe, but I guess I shouldn't do that. But so what happens when you make that 180 degree twist is, from one point of view, clearly they're two sides still, you know. But But if you stay on one side and follow it around, it turns out that one side, because of the twist, turns into the other side. So if it's like this, as long as you're on one side, you stay on one side, you never get to the other side. As soon as it's like this, one side is the other side. We should say, I guess, really not one, not two, because one side is the other side, because you can get to it without jumping sides, and at the same time, at any moment, it can also feel as if they're two sides. So I was thinking about that, getting ready for the retreat, and one of the things that occurred to me is that it seems a little bit like a clever joke or a trick. So it's really like this, and some smartass came and said, oh, it's like that. And so that could be something a topologist does, somebody who thinks about mathematical spaces and says, I'm a topologist, I'm smarter than you are, it only has one surface. Or it sounds like, as Hakman would say, a trick performed by a Zenist. Only in a Zen retreat would you see something like that, you know. And then it occurred to me that really you could tell the story another way, and I think in a way it's truer, you know, that things were like this, and somebody did that. And then you grow up for a couple thousand years after people have kept doing that, and that's the way it occurs. But in some way, who knows really, you know, but it's like that, and then there's that, you know. So that's very close to the story, and I don't want to get too academic or tell you things you already know or are not interested in, but that's very close to what people say about what's called in the trade the accession to language. Once you become a speaking being, once you're in language, really, you live in a world where that's happened. And we know all kinds of ways in which that's true, and I'll just try to talk about a couple of them without going into too much detail. So certainly, language gives us a world of binary logic, and we know that. Yes, no, light, dark, strong, weak, and so on. And we begin to live in that world where there are clearly opposites that are opposite from one another. The first thing to say about it, you know, lest again we think that we're trying to leave something behind by being here, is that's incredibly valuable and incredibly useful, and we wouldn't be here if we didn't have the benefit of it, and it's a great joy, and most of us live most of our time there. Computers are the 1-0 version of that, but the operationality, I guess we'd call it, of that, and the degree to which we can manipulate things in an incredibly productive and sophisticated and complicated way is no small thing. So that twist to the Mobius strip, there's something really terrific about it. At the same time, the Xin Xin Ming, among other texts, Trust in Mind, really warns us about some of the unintended consequences of that world of ceaseless binarizing. First of all, just that habit of always sorting things into piles means that we're pretty busy all the time. So you can notice your intelligence being pretty active and busy doing that. And then as the Xin Xin Ming says, it's pretty hard not to go from that to judging. And in the early stages of that, there's probably nothing wrong with that. But that can really get out of control, so that we're always saying good, bad, right, wrong, like, dislike, better, worse. And to the degree that we do that, we're kind of pulling stuff forward and shoving stuff away. And I know for myself, a lot of my time every day is spent, triaging is not the right word because there aren't three, but biaging, you know, saying dividing these things into two piles, makes it really hard to feel like you're in the midst of something that in another way, like that Mobius strip, is one continuous thing. The other thing is that to the extent that you're making those judgments, it's really hard to feel in some way that you're just another thing in the field or in the sea, that you're just another fish there, because you're the one who's sorting things out. And I know we don't always feel that way, but for me, I certainly feel that way a certain amount of the time. Another thing that linguists say, and I'm drawing on the work of Julia Kristeva here, apparently two things happen kind of simultaneously in language learning. And one is you get the ability to predicate. So I guess when you're in the world of only nouns, you're already binarizing to some extent. But when you can say the dog is a mammal, or the fish is a good fish, things like that, when you can begin to make predications, your ability to multiply sort things in multiple layers is much more complicated and much more sophisticated. It turns out that that apparently happens simultaneously with learning to master the pronoun I, which is pretty hard because it's a shifter. When I say I mean me. When you say I, you mean you. And the ability to master the I, in some sense, is supposedly identical with the birth of the ego and with a kind of abstract sense of selfhood. And one of the things we know about the ego, Freud tells us anyway, is that Zen students have a contrary experience sometimes, but you can't ordinarily dream your own death. You know, the ego, usually if you're going to die, you wake up. That's a very common experience. And so in some sense, there's this kind of abstract, universal selfhood that doesn't exactly feel mortal and doesn't feel like a regular thing, that stands over against the world of objects as a kind of abstract subject. And that apparently happens at the same time as sorting things into these binary piles. And so that distinction between I is the knowing subject who's somehow not in the field, as if looking at it through binoculars, and everything else out there that I can judge, is one of the things that tends to happen once we're in language. And once we're there, we really are in a world that's got two surfaces in some way. There's the inside and the outside, and we're on the inside and everything else is on the outside. Emerson gives this an extreme formulation where he says, strictly speaking, the world is divided into two categories. And I think he knew how outrageous this was. He says, there's I and the abyss. You know, everything else is kind of dark, you know. So we're no longer one of the fishes swimming in the water. And it gives us a tremendous amount of operational power over the world, but at some cost. So I would suggest, and the phallic part of this is no accident, that like Groucho, you know, who said he enjoyed his cigar, but he took it out of his mouth every once in a while, that we try and retreat to try to take the cigar out of our mouths every once in a while and not, you know, not be so sure that we're on one side and we know what's on the other side, or this is over here and that's over there. All right. One of the things I want to suggest is that the Coens, as a rule, with that kind of twisty dream logic, are pretty good at doing that. So there's that. Another thing I want to suggest is that the particular Coens I hope to look at least in the talks I give, are all in some way about that. What happens when it feels like this, and then it starts to feel like that instead? I'll say one thing as a kind of digression and then read you one thing to close. It's a digression because we haven't got to the Koan yet, but one of the things that often happens in retreat, partly because our visual field is fairly limited for a lot of the day, is that sounds start really becoming present to us, and we have a relation to them that we may not ordinarily have. Things moving that we maybe see on a break if we're a little dreamy, the kind of motion quality of things moving can also begin to impress itself upon us. And I would just encourage you to be interested in the moments where you're not primarily or only seeing. There's something about the visual field that really does the sort of here and there, here versus there, in a sharper way than touch or motion or sound does. So just while you're waiting for the Coens to click in, if you just get a little dreamy with your sensorium, I think that's another way of beginning, in a way, to let that twist happen. And there are many moments in a retreat where it really does feel that something is twisted. It's a very common experience working with a Coen that you're getting very deep in it. And since you're a thinking being, aside from anything else that's going on, you have the feeling of also you're figuring it out, which is sort of a distraction, but maybe not. And then you get to a point, and the thing just turned on you, and you realize that you can't make sense to yourself anymore at all, and that in some way took you deeper into the world of the Koan, that you were saying, oh, I got it figured out, and then some way a cog slips, and it doesn't make any sense anymore in the terms that you were trying to use to grapple with it in some way, and then something else happens. So what I want to do now, it'll take just a few minutes. One of the Koans that I hope to get to is the Two Shens. And It turns out that's derived from a folk tale, and I just want to read this to you as a kind of bedtime story. You know, here's the folk tale without the koan. The prose is a little purple because Robert Aiken takes it from Lafcadio Hearn, a late 19th century British author who was very interested in Zen. So it's a little bit like Victorian literature, but it's about two pages, so take a few minutes to read. And this is kind of the backstory, the folk tale that the koan grows out of. And if it doesn't make any sense to you, if it seems silly, that's fine. Maybe it'll enter your dreams or your thoughts at some point. It's got that kind of fairy tale quality. There lived in Hangyan a man called Chang Qian, whose child daughter Chen was a peerless beauty. He had also a nephew called Wang Chao, a very handsome boy. The children played together and were fond of each other. Once Qian jestingly said to his nephew, "Someday I will marry you to my little daughter." Both children remembered those words, and they believed themselves thus betrothed. When Chen grew up, a man of rank asked for her in marriage, and her father decided to comply with the demand. Chen was greatly troubled by this decision. As for Chao, he was so much angered and grieved that he resolved to leave home and go to another province. The next day he got a boat ready for his journey, and after sunset, without bidding farewell to anyone, he proceeded up the river. But in the middle of the night he was startled by a voice calling to him, "Wait, it is I," and he saw a girl running along the bank toward the boat. It was Chen. Chao was unspeakably delighted. She sprang into the boat, and the lovers found their way safely to the province of Chu. In the province of Chu, they lived happily for 6 years, and they had two children. But Chen could not forget her parents and often longed to see them again. At last, she said to her husband, "Because in former times I could not bear to break the promise made to you, I ran away with you and forsook my parents, although knowing that I owed them all possible duty and affection. Would it not now be well to try to obtain their forgiveness?" "Do not grieve yourself about that," said Chao. "We shall go to see them." He ordered a boat to be prepared, and a few days later he returned with his wife to Hanyang. According to custom in such cases, the husband first went to the house of Qian, leaving Chen alone in the boat. Qian welcomed his nephew with every sign of joy and said, "How much I have been longing to see you. I was often afraid that something had happened to you." Chao answered respectfully, "I am distressed by the undeserved kindness of your words. It is to beg your forgiveness that I have come." But Qian did not seem to understand. He asked, "To what matter do you refer?" I feared, said Chao, "that you were angry with me for having run away with Chen. I took her with me to the province of Chu." "What Chen was that?" asked Qian. "Your daughter Chen," answered Chao, beginning to suspect his father-in-law of some malevolent design. "What are you talking about?" cried Qian, with every appearance of astonishment. "My daughter Chen has been sick in bed all these years, ever since the time when you went away." "Your daughter Chen," returned Chao, becoming angry, "has not been sick. She has been my wife for 6 years, and we have two children, and we have both returned to this place only to seek your pardon. Therefore, please do not mock us." For a moment, the two men looked at each other in silence. Then Qian arose and, motioning to his nephew to follow, led the way to an inner room where a sick girl was lying. And Chao, to his utter amazement, saw the face of Qian, beautiful but strangely thin and pale. "She cannot speak," explained the old man, "but she can understand." And Qian said to her laughingly, "Chao tells me that you ran away with him and that you gave him two children." The sick girl looked at Chao and smiled, but remained silent. "Now come with me to the river," said the bewildered visitor to his father-in-law, "for I can assure you, in spite of what I have seen in this house, your daughter Chen is at this moment in my boat." They went to the river, and there indeed was the young wife waiting. And seeing her father, she bowed down before him and besought his pardon. Qian said to her, "If you really be my daughter, I have nothing but love for you. Yet though you seem to be my daughter, there is something which I cannot understand. Come with us to the house." So the three proceeded toward the house. As they neared it, they saw that the sick girl, who had not before left her bed for years, was coming to meet them, smiling as if much delighted. And the two Chens approached each other. But then, nobody could ever tell how, they suddenly melted into each other and became one body, one person, one Chen, even more beautiful than before, and showing no sign of sickness or of sorrow. Qian said to Chao, "Ever since the day of your going, my daughter was dumb, and most of the time like a person who had taken too much wine. But I know that her spirit was, now I know that her spirit was absent." Chen herself said, "Really, I never knew that I was at home. I saw Chao going away in silent anger, and the same night I dreamed that I ran after his boat. But now I cannot tell which was really I, the I that went away in the boat, or the I that stayed at home." So that's tonight's bedtime story. Thank you, Bodhisattvas.